I've been thinking a lot about analogies, and I like a house analogy a lot. This is coming from a deep trust and safety, passionate professional. Trust is like the foundation of a house, right? A strong foundation for me supports the entire structure. The structure could be your sales, could be your product, anything that assures stability and the future viability of the house. But if the foundation is solid, the employees, but also the customers of the product feel safe. So to me, that is a good example of what I consider trust. And then comes the safety. Safety is almost a set of processes, practices, the things that you might implement for your employees, your users, to protect them from harm. It's like your security system of the house, but one that you're hopefully putting in place proactively and not waiting for that first break-in to happen.
I recently interviewed Subha Vasudevan, SVP of Strategy and Operations at Mozilla. She's a tech optimist and eternal learner who's made a lasting impact in the realm of trust, safety, and responsible innovation. Growing up in Mumbai, Subha was shaped by her parents' unwavering support. Her innate curiosity led her to pursue computer engineering while also working as a journalist, exposing her to the importance of risk management and trust in technology. Over the years, Subha has worked for renowned companies such as News Corp, KPMG and Meta, where she's been a driving force in operationalizing strategies, promoting responsible technology practices. In our conversation, she shares her insights on the importance of education, collaboration, and embracing change in the face of rapid advancements in AI. Subha also discusses the future of work, offering valuable advice on navigating the challenges and opportunities that lie ahead. Now, over to Subha. Subha, welcome to the Impossible Network.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you for doing this. It's been a while since we met at a trust and safety event at the Hold Up Brewery. And back and forth and all the travels and work schedules. Finally, we're doing this, which is amazing.
I love it. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's jump in. Let's start with a big question. Who are you as a human being?
You know, that question made me think. I would say if I were to, you know, characterize myself, I am an optimist. That's the best way I like to put it. I am a tech optimist. I'm an optimist about the kindness and the goodness in the world. And eternal optimist, but not naive. I also like to think I am constantly evolving, curious, someone who loves learning from other humans. And I love a good adventure. By the way, by adventure, I mean, it could be geeking out on the latest AI advancements or reading books of fiction. They're all adventurous. Or tackling twin parenting issues at home on the weekends. Because, hey, life is the main adventure, right? I hate roller coasters, by the way.
Well, you got two children. You're going to be on them at some point, physically and metaphorically. Yeah.
Physically, yeah, work me, yep.
Well, that's a great answer. And in today's world, certainly, I think we have to be optimists because what's the alternative? Particularly in positions of influence and power that you're in, I think it serves you well to be that. So that leads to the second big question. Given that you're this curious, adventurous optimist, but realist as well, what or who made you who you are as a human being?
I love this question because I think it is always more than one entity, right? We have so many influences that shape us. I'm going to start by saying I grew up in Mumbai, or Bombay as it was known back then. The city of Mumbai shaped me, and absolutely my parents as well, right? For example, my parents making me feel like I could do anything that I set my heart or my mind to absolutely shaped me. Think of them as these normal, you know, Indians who were just trying their best to make ends meet and give me, their only child, the best education possible. But in doing so, they taught me some very important values that I still hold dear and true, and hopefully I'm passing on to the next generation. Values around relationships building, values around the spirit of hard work, of continuous learning, all of that. And then I mentioned Mumbai or Bombay. It's a dizzying pace. I don't know if you've been there, Mark. It's a dizzying pace.
I've just been to Delhi.
Yeah, well, Mumbai is different.
Yeah.
We can get into that argument some other time. But it's a dizzying pace and a lovely city with a lot of diversity. It absolutely makes me who I am. There's no time for politics or drama. And it's a bit of a go, go, go kind of city. And I consider myself well aligned with that part of Mumbai.
Interesting. It's funny. I've interviewed such a diverse range of people. Across the years I've been doing this. And I've always been struck by people that, I mean, I suppose in a way I fit into the category as well, that immigrant to the US, legal immigrant. But it's people that have come from Asia particularly. I've noticed that their parents have instilled in them both that hard work ethic, but also a sense of self-belief and an attitude to life, as you say, that anything is possible. And yet, I grew up in a country like Britain, and this is very much, and I've been interviewed in the podcast about the difference between Britain and America. You haven't got that. Parents tend not to instill in their children this sense of self-belief. There's almost, it's almost the opposite. It's the questioning, are you good enough? It inhibits, I think, so many people I see around me from my upbringing and friends and family. I'm witnessing my sister's kids grow up, and it's limiting. These self-imposed limiting beliefs that are instilled by parents. And it reassures me in the future that when I hear people like you talk about the way that your parents have passed on to you that attitude and that you're doing it for your children, that it's creating an expansive generation of children and people believe that they can change the world for the better. So I think it's really good to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah, that's a good call out. And I should also clarify, all those memes you see and hear about Asian parents or Indian parents, in a way that is true. That's actually very true, where nothing you do is good enough is actually true of our upbringing, especially academics. You know, there are jokes like, you got a 99? That's not good enough. You should be getting one. But it was also my point around, I could do anything that I set my mind to is also from the angle of the girl and the gender issue. You know, India definitely had a lot of issues when it came to parts of India just did not want to have girl children or female infanticide. And, you know, several parts of India was a big thing. It still is, if I'm not mistaken, in hopefully smaller pockets. But in that regard, my parents absolutely encouraged me. They didn't think my gender would limit me from being able to accomplish anything. So that sort of was one of the biggest, most empowering parts of having them as my parents and shaping me.
What about siblings?
Only child, which is part of the deal.
Okay, so no sibling rivalry to sort of spur you on. Okay, so given that encouragement and that environment in which you grew up in, what were those early ambitions as you were growing up with this belief that anything was possible? What was sparking that curiosity, whether it be innate or whether it be nurtured?
So, you know, anything was possible was tempered by a sense of the practicality. Look, we weren't people of means who would take fancy vacations every year or have a car or none of that, right? So simple, hardworking family. So for me, it was important to have financial security as I was growing up or after I, you know, knew that I started working. That was an important aspect of things. And the Indian belief system was absolutely about academics. So all of that also shaped me. That said, I don't think I had a notion of an exact career. I hadn't gone that far in my thinking. It's funny because when I was in my 11th grade or something, I heard a friend talk about computer engineering. And that felt like the right thing for me to do because my father was also an engineer by training and you're surrounded by people who are engineers and doctors in India. So that felt like the right thing though for me. So I was like, okay, that's the bachelor's degree I'm going to pursue. I also decided to write but out of passion, and this is where the empowerment comes in. And my parents encouraged me to send it in. It got published. I sent something in to a newspaper on a whim. It got published. And then eventually I got invited back to as a teen journalist. So while getting my computer engineering degree, talk about left brain, right brain, I also started working as a journalist in India and did that for a few years. During that time, though, especially during the Y2K era, if people remember you know, I started to kind of hone in on how banks in India seemed super underprepared. And I realized that was the first inkling of this curiosity, research, level of detail, but also what could go wrong in the world that started to develop in my brain. I think that exposed me more and more to the notion of risk management, eventually leading to trust and safety.
Interesting. Yeah, so the intersection of engineering and the arts. It's funny, you could have gone down another route. You could have become a sort of the Indian Kara Swisher as a journalist, high-tech journalist.
I wish, right? That would be amazing.
Yeah. That's interesting. So that that inkling that it gave you into the sort of the whole world of trust and safety isn't something that many people were really thinking about. I remember Y2K, and at the time I was working in advertising on the Microsoft account of all things, and just remember the sort of the paranoia that was really grabbing everyone. It was just this fear and anxiety over what would happen, and then suddenly nothing, and everything was okay. But even back then, in those sort of early days, as technology was evolving and it was growing, no one really knew or was even really thinking in the mainstream about what was coming with the impact of AI and pre sort of the mobile phone era and pre-social media era. Technologies always move fast, but at that time, did you have any inkling of how fast technology was actually sort of occurring and the speed of the evolution and the impact it would have on business and society and culture? Even so, you were thinking about trust and safety. At what point did you suddenly wake up to the bigger picture that actually this is exponential change happening in real time around me?
You know, I don't think it was a one-day overnight aha moment for me, but heck yeah, journalists have to stay ahead of changes. They have to be able to predict the future. They have to think intellectually and sharply and more practically. So you combine that level of exposure and those conversations I was having with such people, such smart people, with the technical education I was getting and the smart technical people in my engineering college, that was like the best of two worlds. And it started to evolve in my brain. And I realized more than just writing or coding, I wanted to find an intersection of technology and business, because I knew being technical, and it means many things, but having a good sense of technology would be super critical, no matter what I did in life. This was for me, at least. And that there is something that would shift with respect to its impact to business. I had not thought about society and culture, I'll admit. I was too young, but I was thinking a lot about impact to business. And therefore, I came to the US then to get a master's in information systems, because that felt like the right mix of the two areas that I wanted to be in the middle of. It was a gradual evolution learned from both sides of the house.
Because one of the things I'm always fascinated with, why I started the podcast, was really an exploration my own curiosity about how serendipity plays a part in people's journey and life. Sounds, the way you're talking, it was a very conscious, rational decision. But usually when you pull back the layers, serendipity plays a part somewhere along everyone's journey. What about you?
Yes, it does. And you know, my version of it, I'll tell you, is these random conversations with random friends that would stick in my brain and just take on a life of their own. Like I said, a friend of mine was talking about computer engineering. That stuck in my brain. Another friend, when I was working for a channel, it was called Channel V or vindia.com back then in India, a competitor to MTV. And he mentioned something about, you should really think about a career in risk management, systems risk management. I didn't know what it meant. I didn't even track him down and like dig into it. He gave me a high level notion. He was either a CTO or, you know, some such career at that company. So he passed it in dropping, and it took root in my brain. So that's my example of these serendipitous moments that lead to something in the future. It took root in my brain. Somehow that led to me falling into those careers for decades.
So that path to the US led you to Austin, to UT?
No, you got it wrong. No. I went to Texas A&M, UT's rival.
Oh, the rivals.
I need a Longhorn, if that helps.
No. When I first came here, I didn't realize the sort of the rivalry that sort of bubbles under the surface and sometimes over.
Absolutely over.
Yeah. So once arriving here and looking just at your career trajectory, you've worked in many areas of businesses. I mean, you say you've had that intersection between business and technology, journalism and engineering. And you've worked in, I believe, News Corp, KPMG, Meta, all fascinating companies. you're respected for your ability to operationalize strategies through that sort of that journey. This work you do in trust, safety, integrity, and what you call responsible technology are all terms we're becoming increasingly familiar with over the last few years, last decade. But I don't think people really, it sounds good. You go, oh yeah. When you start to unpack them, what do they really mean in terms of the impact on people's lives?
Yeah. You, even as I was hearing you talk, I was like, it does sound like jargon or a word salad.
Well, yeah, it is. That's the thing. They roll off the tongue easily, and you hear them all the time on podcast interviews, but I think they sort of go over people's heads.
The silver lining, as you said, is that a lot more people are hearing these terms. That's good, because I remember when I first landed a job at KPMG in their risk management practice, and I called my parents in India to tell them, and they said, what? What is information risk management? So, and how does it matter, right? And that's a question like I have had to both learn and answer for people over the years. So let me take a best stab at it the way I see it, and maybe you can extract something better and more from me. So trust and safety, let's talk about that. That's super important and has some real world implications, particularly given the technological wave we're facing right now. So when I think about trust in a business context, it refers to based the confidence that any customer or partner or stakeholder might have in that company's product or services or brand, or just anything that the company does. That only happens if the company can demonstrate sort of consistent, ethical, reliable behaviors and a real commitment to building that trust for users. So I've been thinking a lot about analogies, and I like a house analogy a lot. So think about trust as, and again, this is coming from a deep trust and safety, passionate professional. Trust is like the foundation of a house, right? A strong foundation for me supports the entire structure. The structure could be your sales, could be your product, anything that assures stability and the future viability of the house. But if the foundation is solid, the employees, but also the product, the customers of the product feel safe. They feel secure in the house. So to me, that is a good example of what I consider trust. And then comes the safety. Safety is almost a set of processes, practices, the things that you might implement for your employees, your users, et cetera, to protect them from harm. There's, of course, physical safety, data security, protecting users from harmful content or interactions, all of that stuff, right? It's like your security system of the house, but one that you're hopefully putting in place proactively and not waiting for that first break-in to happen. Whether it's a fire extinguisher or a lock or a door alarm, it doesn't matter. And sometimes trust and safety put together can be interchangeably used with the word integrity. I don't think there's anything much more different, but it's just sometimes a nomenclature or taxonomy difference from company to company. But for me, overall, when you take all these terms, evolving responsible technology also means designing and deploying it in ways that prioritizes these considerations of how users feel in consuming that technology and how much they can trust the company and the brand as a result. So that's my best explanation of trust and safety and integrity, mm-hmm. at least. I can also explain other things if you like on it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the idea of foundation, a security system in a house analogy is a really good way. And I'll definitely be using that when I have conversations with other people around it. I suppose when you use the term responsible technology, that then becomes conditional to the specific organization, the technology that they're deploying, presumably, whether it be an AI solution or social media, or all AI is going to be in everything, let's face it. But if it's hardware, software, it's got to be done in terms of the relationship. Presumably it's related to their own governance, code of ethics. Would that be fair?
Yes. Well, let me give you a good example from, or practical example that is, you know, externally shared from my days working for Meta. Mm-hmm. I was part of multiple different organizations over 11 years there. And one of the teams I led for a long time was ads or business integrity, really ads, trust and safety. So imagine this. Imagine that you are you own a bakery. Let's imagine you own a bakery, a small mom and pop shop around the corner, and you want to run an ad for your bakery. That ad on Facebook, as you're the consumer, Facebook is a brand that you're choosing to give your dollars to run this ad for you. So you need to feel, first of all, as an advertiser, that your ad is going to run and give you the best return on your investment, all that stuff. But also, you're not going to see your ad next to something super crappy, which that's the safety of your brand. And then me as a consumer waking up, looking at my feed, Facebook feed, I want to see good ads that I care about, which is things like a bakery, not something crappy. And hopefully your advertising copy isn't something scandalous or something that's about targeting teenagers with violence, or, you know, it's about weapons safety issues, or there's a whole set of, or you shouldn't be running a scam Bitcoin ad, which happens a lot, disguised as a bakery ad, right? So there's a lot of ways in which things can go wrong. So as a combination of machine learning or AI and humans, a lot of the work that we did was about making sure we enabled and ensured safety or trust, I would say, between the consumers, the advertisers, and the company itself. And of course, that extends to regulators, how they see you, and all that stuff. But that was for many years, multiple teams working on it, not just mine, multiple leaders. We felt like it shaped my life's work in trust and safety in some respects, ads integrity.
If you reverse it and say that the desired outcome is consumer trust, presumably it's fair to say that only when you're operating as a technology company with integrity, being responsible, can you engender and generate trust in the consumer? Because that ultimately, the way you're describing it, and just think about how personalized and often relevant and surprising, sometimes when you get an Instagram ad that pops up in front of you, you go, wow, this is amazing. I've been looking for this sort of knee rehabilitation technology solution for, I would never have discovered it, but it's almost serendipitously, it pops up in my feed. That results in me going, okay, I trust this to understand me and get it right. So yeah, I can understand that. So I think we've maybe hopefully covered what is responsible technology in that context. That's good. Thank you for that. So we answered the first big questions. Who are you as a human, and what made you, or who made you you? Given that trajectory that you've been on in your journey, and assuming there are many more years to come in that journey, what are you now working on to achieve an impact before you shuffle off this mortal coil? Because you are now at Mozilla, a very different organization.
Exactly, a very, very focused on responsibility and doing things differently. So before I shuffle off this mortal coil, my mission, I would say, is to make some sort of a lasting impact. I wouldn't say this is, at the end of the day, my life's mission is to inspire my kids and inspire newer generations to do things better than the previous ones. As a parent, that comes first. But such that my career can help others, or I can do things while I'm working, it is to have some sort of lasting impact in the realm of technology and business coming together. I believe trust and safety was one of those endeavors, those worthy endeavors at Meta. I also think responsible innovation, pushing for that, the notions that Mozilla believes in, it's affording me that opportunity to help the company further that, right? Whether it's privacy-preserving advertising, since we talked about ads, that one of my teams at Mozilla is working on, it's something I'm super proud of. We're taking on things and doing them in very unique ways. So whether it's that, or whether it is thinking about AI, and AI is a massive technology wave today across Mozilla, and thinking about it differently, right? I'm excited for some of the investments we are putting in that'll pay off over the long term. So personally, if I were to look back, hopefully 10, 20, whatever years later, each of these moments of my life will feel like a worthy endeavor and not a waste of time, not just a job. Again, don't forget, there's a lot of grind that comes with it. It will feel like just a job in many ways for many people. It's not my point. My point is it all leads to something useful in the world.
I didn't put the question in the actual sort of question doc, but I heard this interview a couple of days ago with someone, and they asked the question, what's your relationship with AI, either on a professional or a personal basis?
It is one that I believe everybody should adopt, lean into, and not be afraid of. And I am absolutely one of those who's been toying around with LLMs I don't know, since early last year, for example. Professionally, it could be because of my technology or engineering background. I just feel like it's inherent in who I am and how I operate. It could be that natural curiosity that I developed as a journalist in predicting the future. And it absolutely is, at Meta, we were AI first, machine learning first back in the day. When I say AI back in the day, it was all machine learning techniques. And that's how our systems operated, systems of humans with the technology that took care of trust and safety. So for me, my thinking has been completely technology first or AI first, which means when LLMs came around and became more of a consumer-facing thing, that was a wow moment for me, tempered with, wow, so much can go bad. Mm-hmm. You know, and I am going to absolutely lean into it, use the hell out of it, learn it, test it, and know what can go bad and try to prevent it. Because you cannot prevent the technological advancement. You've got to learn how to put the guardrails and the mitigations in place.
Having worked at different types of organizations and the type of organization that Mozilla is now, do you think it's going to be hard, challenging, let's say, given the pace of and the competitive pace of change that's happening in the AI space, for those guardrails to be put in place in time to maintain, to ensure sufficient trust in AI products that are being rolled out at a pace I don't think any of us have experienced before?
Yeah, I'll give you like a world example. This isn't about Mozilla. In the world, I actually think there are some really good companies focused on true guardrails who care about trust and safety in the world of LLMs, right? Like most technological innovations or most new products, everybody's focused on first mover's advantage. How can we leap into the fray? How can I take on OpenAI or best them or whatever, right? So there is a new sort of big tech movement that's almost happening. I call it big tech. You can call it whatever. But it's almost this new wave of technology company movements that are happening. And some of them, like Anthropic, for example, are very focused on trust and safety guardrails and so on and so forth. Then you have a lot of collaborative efforts happening around defining things like closed AI systems versus open systems. So the notion of open source software has suddenly changed. Like, it's not open source software, it's the entire stack of an AI system that has multiple places where it could be opened. Mm-hmm. So security researchers can mess around with it, but also bad actors could use it. Mozilla firmly believes that open is good in general. That's been our belief, right? So that's where we would be investing our time and energy. At the same time, we also believe that users need to be given choice. It's not about, and the choice is not about the openness of the stack. It's about you need to have the choice in, you need to know, you need to be educated, you need to have transparency, you need to know what you're getting into, and then pay for the LLM product, don't pay, that's up to you, so long as you know what you're getting into. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the notion behind all of this. There are lots of collaborative efforts now starting to happen. I think the EU, as always, has been more ahead. I think there was an original EU AI Act that was in 2021, if I'm not mistaken, I could be getting the date wrong, for a more comprehensive regulatory framework around AI. And then since then, there's been a lot more happening in the EU. But I do see a bunch of stuff spinning up now.
I'm sure we'll come back to talk about this question of open source and particularly models like Llama 2 and all that, where the risks lie down the road. But in 2023, you had a blog post where you outlined some key areas for responsible AI development, including collaborative efforts, investment in trust and safety, and reskilling to harness economic opportunity. We're approaching, and UK literally timestamped this, announced elections on July 4th. We've got the US elections, we've had the India elections, we've got Mexico in a couple of weeks' time. With the risks, you talked about in your blog post about the risks of deep fakes, and then there's always the question of foreign interference, and they're all looming large. What progress have you observed in these areas? And what advice could you offer potentially just to help, people who are encountering these elections and probably aware of the risks that they face when they're consuming content? What advice could you give to help navigate maybe some of this challenges coming at us in this landscape?
I really think it's important to look at it from the perspective of educating yourself, because with LLMs and other advancements in technology, it's become very easy for bad actors to further their own scams and deepfakes and misinfo. Misinfo and disinformation has existed for as long as time, it feels. It was in-person disinformation warfare way back when. Now it's all online, and that has sped up things, and LLMs will speed up the ability to create and distribute some of all of the crap that we see out there. As users, and this starts with children also, and it includes the vulnerable like the elderly, it is super important to educate everybody and make sure that we lean into these technological times, as I said before, live with it, don't fear it, right? Which means serious education on spotting these things so that even if they're not mitigated out there, you don't fall prey as an individual and that you don't live in a bubble, you form the best opinion. To me, there is a big societal and human aspect to it. I see a bunch of schools now and other organizations really focusing efforts on it, which makes me feel the hope. When it comes to AI safety and security, there's also the second piece is you have, I think it's Hugging Face that has some sort of a secure LLM safety leaderboard, or you have other companies that are starting to put out research papers. There's so many papers, academics putting out things that are coming out, which I hope shifts the narrative and the conversation on safety and security within AI once again, like it did a few years ago. Once again, with this new wave, we need it. And then the third piece, and I was talking to a group yesterday, I don't have their permission, so I won't name them. They're doing some incredible work, but they said in the space of elections, instead of fighting misinformation, why not put good information out there? And I really appreciated that approach. Their job, they see as, I'm going to keep arming you with all the information, the facts that you need and the good information. And, hopefully you're educated enough and you're smart enough to start pulling out the signal from the noise. I am an optimist. So I like to make an assumption that humans are inherently smart, good people, and we do fall prey to bad things and tactics. How can we help each other get better at that?
It's interesting. At South by Southwest, I went to a lot of AI events and covering a whole gamut, but quite a few of them were around governance and ethics and trust and safety. And one of the ones came up about elections. So we're talking about they didn't believe that the risks would be at the presidential level. It would be more down ballot at local elections, where you've got in really key swing districts, right at that critical moment in time where maybe the mechanisms aren't in place to spot deepfakes or misinformation, disinformation. That's where the greatest risk lies. And it'll probably only come to light after the election. But they said there's enough going on within the whole election infrastructure to spot the obvious deepfakes that you'd expect from the main candidates. But it's in those smaller sort of swing states where the risk lies. So I think it'll be interesting to observe and see what happens there.
You already have bots on things like Nextdoor dividing neighbors for school elections. And they're bots. They're clearly bots. You don't even need LLMs for that kind of activity, right? So that's interesting, though.
I sent I don't know if you saw the report that came the other day from, I think it was from Microsoft, about the future of work and AI and for business leaders. And I shared an article, I think Ethan Mollick wrote a piece for the Financial Times, shared with a friend who can't say who she works for, but she's CEO of a big retailer and fashion brand, and who openly admits that they're maybe not moving at the pace they should be. And I think in that article, Mollick said, or I think the report said, business leaders, when they ask a question, they're obsessed with asking, will AI matter? They have to stop asking if and start shaping how it will matter in their business. And
exactly.
And that also it's going to change management and create balance between, and leaders have to strike a balance between empowering and supporting the workforce, but also respecting their autonomy and their privacy. And I think that I thought that was interesting, that it's not just about the practical reality of how you're using it, when you're using it, and if workers feel confident enough to say they're using it. and that most organizations are slow to develop that policy. But it's actually changing the role of management, and it's going to change the nature of how we think about leadership in companies. So it's a much more expansive sort of impact that it's having. So when we talk about leaders, business leaders, what would your advice be to them in terms of the primary considerations that they need to be self-cognizant of when embracing AI into their organizations through the lens of what you look at?
Yeah. Through the lens of what I'm responsible for. And right now, it's not just trust and safety. I have a bunch of other teams, leading strategy, analytics, operations. I have a much broader lens now. I think about this a lot. I think about it as a boon in many ways, in that if done right, obviously there's a way this could go terribly wrong, but if done right, and if companies adapt to Gen AI and adopt these technologies well, hopefully we battle things like burnout in humans. We're all humans, you know. If you learn how to free up your time and put the tool to work for you in smart ways, and you really lean into it, I think, imagine the hours it gives you back. And for example, I shared this with my leads who report to me and my peers. You know, we had a little bit of a gathering 2 weeks ago or something at this point. And typically in organizing and planning for those things, I would spend hours creating the documentation and the topics and the run of show and what I want to facilitate. I made the tool work for me, that too, on the flight over, with the flight in-flight Wi-Fi, which we know can be tricky. It saved me at least 4 hours of weekend work, if not more. Guess what? That was weekend back, either to read a book or to spend with my kids or whatever.
Get on a roller coaster.
anything but that. My broader point being, if you can make it work for you, it can really unlock productivity, which means less burnout. Of course, there's a big creative angle to it. Of course, it's still, there's a lot of hallucinations. You can ask it a math problem, often it gets it wrong, any of these LLMs. So you have to be smart about how you use it. And there's no way avoiding it. You can be afraid of it and run away from it, but it's like the old SAP systems or the Oracles or whatever that people didn't want to implement for a long time. And then companies finally did it and realized the net benefits to improved internal processes and how people work with each other. I think those are the net benefits. That's how I think about it. So again, that's my optimist side. On the trust and safety angle, I absolutely think you don't want inaccurate information, you don't want to make mistakes, but you also want security. I mean, it boils down to the security and safety. And as you rightly pointed out, you don't want someone to feel like, I don't want someone monitoring my activity with the LLM. But I would say it's similar, as a company, you need to get wise about similar policies to how you would monitor people otherwise on the internet. A lot of companies have internet monitoring policies, which I hope they do away with, but that Mozilla doesn't do that, Meta didn't do that. But my broader point being, it's similar. It's not very different in that regard.
Do you see any other changes coming? The way, when I read this article and this piece about how it's actually going to sort of redefine the role of management, That was made me suddenly go, oh, wow, I've not been thinking about this in a broad enough sense. Do you think there are any other sort of emerging trends in the way that organizations may have to foster new relationships, whether they be with academia, policymakers, the public, to change the nature of how organizations work?
Absolutely. And we've in fact been talking to one of Mozilla's board members is a Harvard Business School professor. So in talking to him, Kareem, he's been sharing a lot about a lot of his wisdom gained from working with these technologies. So for us, that is reliant on someone who's both been a professor for a very long time, but also works with a lot of companies and corporates. The reality is it's a new technology wave. We're all learning together. So you do need to widen your network of people that you learn from and build together as a leader, as management. You can't live in a bubble. Also, think simple things like, people hire internal consultants, process consultants. Those consultants hopefully are ones who are very Gen AI and technology first and not bringing old methodologies.
You'd hope so.
That's a tool for leaders to think like that. You don't instinctively think like that. So there's lots of stuff like that you have to change in your own mindset. But also I would say as a leader, how you use the tool yourself is both good role modeling and good learning. So if you're not in there rolling up your sleeves, learning from the tool, using it, seeing its pitfalls in addition to its strengths, how are you going to let your company do that? Like, how are you going to help the company do that, right? So that's my two cents on leadership.
Okay. I want to get your perspective as a parent. And you mentioned you've got two children. Everyone I've spoken to about AI and their parents, they talk about education, where the future lies, and you know what's their kids' education going to be like 5 years down the line, let alone 10 years, even 2 years is going to change. And given the pace it's moving at, yet we know how slow the education system is to evolve. And aside from I'd love to get a sense of what you think their view is, but how do you guide them and how do you think about it as a parent, knowing what you know, because you've got a unique lens to view the future?
Yeah. So I have a very similar philosophy with my kids as I do at work, which is educate them on the dangers and the risks. This is like teaching them stranger danger, right? In the real world. It's like teaching them about scam texts you could receive when you first get a watch or a phone. It extends to, you know, how LLMs can sow misinformation or you know, how social media can have both a good side and a bad side. It's all about, it's the same thing. So I have actually encouraged my children at home, for example, if we're going on a trip, use ChatGPT, help me plan the trip itinerary. So I encourage them to use it, or they use Meta AI in WhatsApp to generate silly pictures all day long. Or have a good laugh with the family, right? It's a bonding moment. But I realized that's got to be in the vocabulary of the family and of our society in the future. So might as well give them a head start on it. It's like any other technology wave or foundational element to technology. So no point shielding or preventing. Lean into it, know the dangers, know how to make it work for productive, good reasons. That's sort of my three guiding principles for the kids as well. Mm-hmm. How do you do it, Mark?
Well, my daughter's grown up, so I'm helping her with it in her job, because I think her organization are way behind in terms of how they're using it. But for my nieces and nephews who've got young kids, you know, I'm having continuous conversations with them about how they can start to take more responsibility for their children's education, things that the school won't be doing, by educating on the use of it. Particularly if we think about the talents, the key characteristics children are going to need going forward: curiosity, creativity, collaboration, building connection and community. So all these sort of C's we can think of roll off. How do you start to nurture that? How do you, you know, if you think back, if you were growing up today with your passion for at the intersection of journalism and technology, you'd be using Code Interpreter. You'd probably be using it to help trigger your writing, to give you ideas, to spark your creativity. I mean, one thing coming away from at South By, I don't know if you managed to attend, but watching Amy Webb do her annual talk on trends, where she talked about we're at this technology super cycle where we've got AI, three general purpose technologies coming together: AI, biotech, and the Internet of Things. And the impact that's going to have is going to be beyond anything we've ever imagined before. And when we think about it, it does beg the question, what does it mean for us as human beings in the workplace and at home? And we have to start to re-examine who we are as human beings, what makes us innately human. So I think it's forcing us, both as individuals and as parents and as leaders, to actually question some of the deeper existential questions. You know, how do we nurture curiosity in everyone? How do we ensure that our ingenuity marks us out as different? So I think it's a very interesting time and fascinating. And as you said, I don't think anyone's got any of the answers.
I agree.
And I'd love to ask you what other things we should be talking about AI, but let's get on to some quick fire questions. Oh, before we do, you have this philosophy called the do differently philosophy. Let's just very quickly just give me an explanation of that.
Yeah. I actually learned the words from a former manager, so I'll give all credit where it's due to that manager. It's not mine. I didn't make it up. But I've always been that way when it comes to, you know, picking out something to wear, or I don't know. It's not about the need to stand out of the pack. That's not it. I always believe it's the creativity aspect. just because every company has been doing a process a certain way doesn't mean we need to do it the same way, right? Or just because trust and safety or strategy or operations is done a certain way and has certain first principles, you don't get to just stick to it. You got to challenge it. And that's the only way to get better. That's my mindset. And coming to Mozilla last summer actually afforded me that opportunity. We call it the Mozilla way here, which is beautiful because it is different. It's about responsible practices and showing how technology can be done differently, which is what excites me about a company like Mozilla. So the do differently really came true for me in joining Mozilla.
Cool. I like that. Okay, then. So who or what inspires you?
So many people. It's really hard for me. And it could also be something as simple as a walk that I take in the morning. So it doesn't have to be a lofty person or a book that they wrote. I get inspired by the little things in nature, or, you know, two animals fighting and figuring it out, you know.
Okay. What principles do you live by?
I think it goes back to what I said earlier about what shaped me. For me, it is relationships are very important in life. Second, hard work, but not for the sake of. I mean, you can put in hard work and it can be absolutely useless and worthless. So hard and smart work is very important. I think I just need to feel like I'm contributing no matter what, where. And then three, I think just scaling yourself through others, whether it's at work or whether it is through newer generations, or like you're helping your nieces and nephews. And, you know, for me, it's my kids and the family in general. So I just believe the hero mentality is not good at work and similarly at home as well.
That's nice. We all deal with moments of fear, uncertainty, and doubt. How do you deal with it?
I lean into it. I own it. I'm like, yep, I'm feeling the fear. I mean, we're humans. It's almost weird to not feel it at some point in your life. Acknowledging it, living with it, and then figuring out is my way. I didn't learn it overnight. I obviously, with age comes the maturity to name these things, own these things, and then work through them bite size. Like, it's about picking it apart one by one. I have this funny thing when my kid was, and by the way, I don't know where it came into my brain. I'm sure I read it somewhere. When we moved into this house, my kid was in second or third grade and he wouldn't sleep at night. He would panic and like come running looking for me no matter where I was in the house. I gave him this like little toy tree and said, this is your worry tree. You're going to tell the worry tree everything you're worried about before going to bed each night. And he did that. And he started sleeping in his bed just fine. And it's the silliest thing I've done in my life, but I remind myself about worry trees. And my way of dealing with all this, you know, anything I'm uncertain about or fear, is I either talk it out at home or I write it out. I write, and then it's out of my brain and not spinning anymore. I can actually focus on the execution of it.
Nice. I was going to ask you a question about life hack, but I think you've just answered that one.
I don't have any very good life hacks.
Okay, then.
Sure.
Okay, then. Right. Quiet. On to the next one. Book you'd recommend.
Oh, gosh, I'm a massive fiction reader, so I'll give you one fiction, one nonfiction. At work, I found Atul Gawande's book, The Checklist Manifesto. I really, really, really loved it.
Okay.
And then I love reading a lot of fantasy fiction. N.K. Jemisin, The Broken Earth Trilogy, is a really good one. Check it out if you haven't.
All right. Good. Show someone might not have seen but should watch.
Oh, God. This is probably people have seen it, but The Gentleman on Netflix. It's a Guy Ritchie show, and I'm watching something Guy Ritchie after a very long time, okay. And I love it.
Okay, that's a good one. Go on the list. Final two questions. Are you open to us, because we believe in reciprocity, connecting with other guests to generate random collisions?
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Look out for it. And our final question, which is generating serendipity, which is, who do I interview next?
Oh, gosh. I have a list for you. Can I send you a list?
Absolutely. Just wait. What to do is, we ask for you to make an introduction. So send the list. Once this is edited and out, it'll be probably two and a half weeks from now. Then once it's out, you can share it and say, make the introduction.
Amazing. I have such amazing people I would love for you to talk to.
That would be great. Well, it's been lovely to spend the time with you. Really appreciate it, Suba. I know you're busy, and sad we couldn't have done it in person, but maybe a follow-up at some point. We'll see.
That would be great. Thank you. Good luck with the move.
Bye.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, that's all for now, folks. Now, here's my ask of you. Please follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or whatever player you use. Also, please subscribe to our new Random Collisions newsletter. We really are working to build a global community of action takers, action engines of people that really care about the problems that need solving. Thank you very much, and see you next time.